Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. We are at the end of January 2018. I want to start off by asking for your financial assistance. I want to remind you that I do this full-time as a writer and a researcher. I was the first to do this in English. There are entire websites and political movements now in America that are based on what I've done. It would be nice if they gave me a thank you once in a while, but I am gratified at it. So many of these sites and commentators who are now saying what I was saying 20 years ago, as if they invented it. But it doesn't matter. The fact is that the truth is spreading. Because I research this, and this has to be a full-time job. You cannot be an academic part-time. There's simply too much material to go through. And it isn't so much that this is a reward for my efforts, but it is a means to keep me functional and to keep me keep my house from being sold by the IRS. And as some of you know, I'm a Russian Orthodox priest, and I have a church here on the premises, but I will not claim anything as a tax exemption because of the control that would put on me. Regardless, I do ask for your assistance to be paid, so to speak, for the work that I've done. There are many out there who claim to have a doctoral degree, claim to be academic, and they're no such thing. Mine, of course, is legitimate, and on my website, rushjournal.org, I have my dissertation and all the proper paperwork on there. And when you get a PhD in American university, for someone like me, that's quite an experience because I was faced with every possible hurdle. And what got me through, as I've said many times before, is that they liked me personally. You can't walk into grad school on the first day and talking about Alfred Rosenberg. You have to make sure that they know who you are and that they like you and they know that you're a harmless, good guy. And then you could, you know, then you could talk. And even there, you have to be very, very careful. So I got my PhD at the age of 26. I taught my first university class at 24, which is unheard of, in a very, very hostile environment. And as it turns out, I won many of them over. And again, that comes from your personality. They knew that I was a nice guy and an easy guy to talk with and didn't have an ego or anything like that. And so that's what got me through. I wasn't a threat. I was just nuts. And that's a big, big difference when you're in grad school. Now, that may have changed now, but that's how I did it. And again, a lot of the time, it's not so much making statements. It's asking pointed questions. You can't be accused of something if you're asking a question. So there's ways that you learn, you trial and error, you know, as you get through the academic world. And many have failed. And it's not entirely their fault, although I do know that there are people who claim this kind of discrimination because they're just incompetent. But I'm the genuine article and one of the few academics in the nationalist movement, which is we have a very weak intellectual foundation. And I find myself having to do everything, and I can't. And I wish that we had the institutional backing to give money to students to go to grad school. But, you know, graduate school is really about methods. It's about research methods. And to that extent, it's excellent and it needs to be done. The ideology is another matter. I could ignore that. But the methodology that you learn, when I read someone who is kind of a layman, I know that they haven't gone through, the gauntlet of this kind of intellectual criticism. To learn how to make an argument, to learn what all the fallacies are, how to cite sources in a way that's something more than just saying that this isn't my idea. This is actually an art, and it's quite difficult. And in the field of Russian history, nationalism, political theory, whatever it is, these are highly technical fields. These are not for amateurs. And it goes double for you know, biblical studies in the church. And it fills me with terror that people with no real knowledge are betting their souls on their very limited understanding of the things. I've said many times before that the New Testament, you can't simply pick it up like People magazine. It's not like that. You have to understand the context. You have to understand the Old Testament, the prophets. You have to understand that the modern world has no relation to the world in which Christ lived and worked. And so it's simply a matter of humility to understand that you just don't know. And it's okay to say, I don't know. No one dies when you do that. That being said, today's topic was requested. Paul Angel of the Barnes Review had asked me to do an article on Balakun, whose real name was Bela Cohen, or Cohn, who was very briefly the dictator of the Soviet, the Hungarian Soviet Republic in 1919, was also briefly dictator in Crimea under Lenin, and then finally was supposed to be the dictator of southern Germany, but the revolution there failed miserably. Hungary, in the Hungarian case, is unique in the communist world in this time because the party and the government that existed in 1919 was 100% Jewish. It was an ethnic movement. It was seen as an ethnic movement. And as always, had nothing to do with Marxism. Marxists very rarely care about Marx. They certainly don't care about labor. Labor has never been the target. It's never been the issue. Labor in communist countries was exploited mercilessly. This is an excuse to use the proletarian, very, very easily moved, impressionable group of people in the cities with their ties cut to the village with very little in terms of identity and religion, adrift, the masses, and to use them to take over governments. And that's why they chose the Marxist idea. The proletariat doesn't refer to the workers. It never has. It's a code word. And no more was that the case than in Hungary. It didn't last very long. It was Admiral Nicholas Horthy, who I've written on substantially many years ago. I think it was maybe in 2001, the Barnes Review. I had an article on Horthy from his memoirs. Someone almost totally unknown in the West, seen as a fascist dictator by the idiots, even though he really didn't have much of an ideology and didn't like Hitler all that much. He was the one who took over after the absolutely chaotic rule of Bela Cohn. And he was removed as a sectarian deviationist in the 1930s by Stalin. And he was seen as what they used to call the ultra-left, the farthest left you could possibly be, which was exclusively Judaic and under Trotsky's mantle. And then upon Stalin's death, he was rehabilitated. The ultra-left saw Lenin as too conservative, which is something that was probably never said about him by anybody else. So people like Zinoviev, also Jewish, who was his boss for a while, Karl Radek, also a Jew. And the truth is that Cohn never thought that Marxism could be trusted with or entrusted to a non-Jewish leader or a semi-Jewish leader, someone who wasn't blatantly so like Lenin. And so he was vehemently opposed to Lenin's new economic policy, which was his nod to the market, seeing the economy, and especially the agricultural economy, collapse, not being able to be dependent on Western assistance as he had been up until that point, needed to allow a limited market to function so that people would actually grow things, which was certainly an admission at the time, that the market certainly had a place even for him, and yet you had the Jewish elite who was screaming bloody murder that the new economic policy was benefiting the Gentiles, I mean the bourgeoisie, too much. and it was the only way that he was able to recover after the Civil War. Now, you notice I said Western assistance. I've said this probably in every radio program, and I'll say it for the rest of my life. The West created the Soviet Union. They backed Lenin. They backed the Red Army. And the Soviet Union could never have come into existence without Western assistance, both in public, from governments, and private, from groups like the Red Cross. And any time a famine was alleviated, which is certainly a legitimate thing to do, unfortunately, in the Soviet case, it meant the backing of the Soviet government. Bela Kohn was more of a part of the Russian Revolution than most people realize. He was in the Austro-Hungarian army and was a POW. And as soon as the state began to totter in Russia, he became part of the Red Force. And as is so often the case, Jews never trusted Russians, thought of Russians as, or everyone else, but especially Russians, as beneath them. And it's so often the case with Bela Kohn that Marxism was too lofty to be entrusted with these Gentiles, especially with these Orthodox Gentiles. And he did think that Hungary was a better candidate than Russia because of its long history of local capitalism and what they call primitive accumulation. You have to have capital built for it to be redistributed. But as far as World War I, which was the most significant, one of the most significant events in Western history, which was essentially a liberal revolution that swept away everything conservative in Europe. The crowns were gone, and the capitalists and financiers took over blatantly. But in Austria-Hungary, in Vienna, the currency was reduced to nothing. The economy was in chaos in 1918. And in October of 1918, the so-called Astor Revolution established a weak kind of semi-socialist state under Károly. And this kind of ideological state, almost kind of like a Kerensky in Hungary. And this is where Bela Kohn and his, essentially was a Simki, or a Jewish cult, was able to carve their political niche in vehement opposition to this semi-socialist state. And the fact is that Lenin never trusted him. He used him quite often. But because he was more of, like, very much like Trotsky, he was more of a Jewish nationalist than he was anything else, a secular Jewish nationalist. And so the support from the Soviet Union was weaker than expected, especially since the Soviet Union didn't exist at the time and still was struggling despite the generous funding from Western sources. After World War I, Hungary was cut in half. In 1919, the Treaty of Trianon had reduced Hungary to roughly half of its former size. And there really wasn't much of a conference there that was negotiating it. The so-called Vix Note, which I think is how you pronounce it, V-I-X, was a telegram from the French colonel, Ferdinand Vix, that ordered the Hungarian army to retreat further into the interior of Hungary, where the new border would be drawn. And as the troops retreated, forcibly so, remember the Austro-Hungarian army was in the Central Powers, and it created tremendous outrage. And the nationalist movement began to crystallize, and it toppled the government of Károly in the so-called Astor Revolution. You had a strange confluence of events because it was the USSR that had just come into existence. That was really the only country that was willing to offer assistance in revising this development. So he had been in jail under the Astor Revolutionary state, had Soviet assistance, and now Kuhn's power within the Communist Party was such that, and the backing of the Soviet Union, was that they were negotiating terms with him while he was in a jail cell. And he was dictating terms to his captors from his cell. And in March of 1919, the Soviet Republic of Hungary was announced and, of course, was immediately recognized by the Allies. It's a very rapid series of events based on nationalism, not on any concern with socialism or Marxism. As always, you know, the communists make promises that they never intend on keeping. It's simply a matter of political expediency. They wanted a coalition, and when he was sitting in jail, he wanted a coalition government with the socialists. And as soon as he was comfortable, Lenin gave the order that the astro-revolutionaries be purged. Karoly was arrested, but he had managed to escape to France in the meantime. The new Hungarian Soviet Republic was 100% Jewish. Now, this bothered Bellacone, and he didn't like this idea. The people were talking, you know, even the Allies, even Philo Semites were saying, my God, this is, you know, this is an ethnic state. So he had to find a Gentile in his movement. And after days of searching, he found Sendor Garbai, the only Gentile in that movement, and he made him president. Needless to say, he had no power. But the fact that he had to search for so long to find someone, and you know, this has always been the case in Hungary. The Stalinist dictator that was installed by Stalin after World War II, Rákosi, of course Jewish, he said this about the about the Hungarian Soviet Republic, and you know, Garbai. He said the party's Jewish leaders took the Gentile Garbai so that they would have someone to sign the death sentences on Shabbat. It was a nasty thing to say. And it shows you that even the Jewish leaders of Hungary were aware of this, and were aware that this was simply a tyrannical, anti-Gentile state. I have a paper coming out on this in the Barnes Review, and I have a list of the names, which I cannot pronounce because I don't understand, Magyar pronunciation, and I really don't care. And they're crazy names, and I know that they're not pronounced the way that they look, so I'm not going to try. But I have a list of names. Every last one, except for Garbai himself, is Jewish. Every last one was from a privileged middle-class, at least middle-class family. Now, Marxism had always been a Jewish domain. Socialism was not the case. Socialism has had many, many forms over the millennia. But only when it became materialist and anti-Christian, or anti-religious, but anti-Christian specifically, suddenly Jews became interested. And Kuhn had the name, the title of foreign minister, although, of course, he was dictator of the state. A scholar of the revolution, McCagg, says this in 1972, his work on Kuhn, says the following. The social backgrounds of the revolutionary leaders above 1918 and 1919 are impressively similar to those of the old regime ministers. One of the Bolsheviks, Grigory Lukács, now a famous Marxist philosopher, was like Harkiani, the son of the wealthy banker, and like Harkiani was the exception in the sample. More typical were people like Jassy and Paul something, the leaders of the New Democratic Revolution of 1918. Like the self-made old regime minister, both these men were strikingly successful in their careers as intellectuals and politicians in pre-war Budapest. Although both were born humbly, sons of country doctors in northeast Hungary, none of the fathers of these Jewish revolutionaries tilled the soil, and all derived their livelihood from their education. End quote. In other words, they come from wealthy elites. Probably no state in Europe was more Judaic than Hungary in the sense that Jews were fully free to operate. And it's funny how McCagg mentions that none of them tilled the soil. As you know, that it's forbidden for Jews to become farmers anywhere except the so-called promised land. And they took jobs because of this as parasites, as merchants and bankers. Now, Kuhn's actions as dictator, he wasn't even trying to hide the cynicism of that state. Now, he had promised peasants that he would redistribute all the land to them. He lied, just like the Soviets lied. The first thing he did was nationalize all farmland. Well, that means then that these Jews took over and owned all the land of Hungary. And their campaign against the old government, they promised to redistribute this land to the peasantry, but the moment they took power, they refused. They created Stalinist collectives under their direct control. Now, this is before Stalin, of course. The collectives were simply how they were forced to till the land. These Jews knew nothing about agriculture. And the same thing goes for industry. They had promised worker control over industry, like Tito had in Yugoslavia. But as always, it was simply nationalized and therefore brought under direct control of themselves. So they broke all their promises. They had no intention of allowing Gentiles to run anything. And it wasn't even corruption because this was their open policy. They simply stole everything that wasn't nailed down. And they called what the result was socialism. And the irony of the whole thing was that the party received its support once in power from nationalism. The whole thing comes from the so-called the rejection of the treaty, the desire to create the old Hungarian borders. And it was a nationalist drive to bring Hungarians outside of Hungary within one state. Now, of course, these Jews cared nothing for nationalism, as if that needs to be said. But that was the wave that brought them into power. And they're actually talking like nationalists while the old government was in power. But, of course, the minute they took power, rolled their eyes at it. What made Kuhn even more unique was that when they said property, they meant everything. Usually, when Karl Marx used the word private property, he was referring to productive capital. We kind of mean private property to mean our homes and cars and everything else. That's not what they meant. Property in that context means, fields and machines. But Kuhn used the term in the personal sense. He took jewelry. He took cattle. He took personal property. And he called it the property of the proletariat. But very few people were fooled by this. Now, needless to say, food production collapsed entirely. So, rather than attempt a rational agricultural policy, these Jews who knew nothing about agriculture formed the Red Guards. Now, in their case, it's called the Lenin Boys. These were Jewish thugs, although in this particular case, this very informal group was led by a non-Jew. But they were sent to the countryside to take as much food as they possibly could. And the Lenin Boys, this was the Red Terror. Now, Tibor Samzulik, a name that I'm butchering, I'm telling you right now, a Jewish member of Kuhn's government said the following. Everywhere counter-revolutionaries run about and swagger. We will beat them down. Beat their heads where you find them. If counter-revolutionaries were to gain the upper hand for even a single minute, they'd be no mercy for any proletarian, before they stifle the revolution, suffocate them in their own blood. We know what they mean by proletariat. There'd be no mercy for the Jews. Now, the Lenin Boys were sent out to requisition food, which was common. Lenin did the same thing from the Gentiles in the countryside. But that was just a pretext. The Gentile which led it was Joseph Czerny. Although actually his religious background is in dispute, he was executed after the state had fallen, but he was the head of the Lenin Boys and really served the Jewish state very, very well. And in most of Europe at the time, even the mainstream press called the Red Terror the Jewish Terror. The common people in Hungary would just call it the Jewish government or the Jewish state. When they used the word proletariat in official newspapers, they meant Jews. This was more or less the case elsewhere, but it was certainly the case in Hungary. So this is what McCagg writes in this respect. Actually, he's quoting someone else. Hungary's leading assimilationist Jewish journal, which is called Equality, fell into the hands of reputed Zionists who greeted the revolution in the following euphoric terms. New Hungary is created. The proletarian dictatorship of the poor and oppressed is born. And who could comprehend and greet it better than millennially oppressed Jews? We are the proletariat of world history. The revolutionary flame which has burned beneath the surface of world history is now blazing up for the first time in a Jewish genius, Leo Trotsky. And it is blazing with godlike force which shames every early revolutionary craving and consciousness. Well, you can't get any more obvious of an admission than that. The proletariat referred to Jewish revolutionaries. they go on to then, the Jewish journal Equality goes on to say that these Jewish revolutionaries were of middle class or upper middle class origin. And yet they say the poor and oppressed are ruling the state. By poor and oppressed, they don't refer to people living in poverty. To be oppressed for this Jewish elite is to not have power. But even prior to this, Jews ruled the state. And one of the odd things about and it needs to be explained, and something that McCagg, who is one of the great historians of this era, can't figure it out. He's not allowed to figure it out. Why would Jews join this extreme leftist organization when they actually ran Hungary before? Prior to Kuhn's takeover, at least 12 Jews were in very high positions, holding the rank of state secretary. Prior to 1918, they were not oppressed in any way whatsoever. McCagg argues that the mere fact that a man was a Jew in urban Hungary had no impact. It didn't matter. He writes the following. Characteristically, in Hungary around 1900, the Jews, though they comprised only 5% of the population, occupied almost all key positions of the leading financial sector of the country's economy. They held about 60% of all the important posts in the burgeoning industrial establishment and constituted about half of all people engaged in trade in the booming capital city, Budapest. Even those Jews who lived in villages were the capitalists of the area because the noble landlords for a long time disdained anything to do with commerce, and the peasants were slow to achieve the necessary funds and mobility to go into business. Now, if that doesn't prove that this is simply a Jewish nationalist state, nothing will. There was no reason for Jews to be revolutionaries. They weren't oppressed people. In fact, they ran the state before Kuhn, but never as such. They worked with Gentiles. The church was free and functioned. They had to watch their P's and Q's at that time. Even George Lukács, who became a famous Marxist philosopher, was a son of a millionaire banker. And his father did funnel money to the Marxists. So really, you have a situation where the ruling class engaged in revolution against itself. And McCagg is trying to figure out why this could be. How can the Jews, who essentially ran a good portion of the state prior to Kuhn, would create a revolution against the old government? And he argues very weakly. He says, well, because they're urban and foreign. He says, its minority status and its foreignness can thus account for their interest in revolutionary change. Well, it doesn't say anything. McCagg knows the answer. He just can't utter it. The most obvious answer to his question is that in taking over under Kuhn, they strengthened their control and ownership of the economy from, say, 50% to 100%. Obviously, the revolution had no impact on labor. Labor had no power and were ruled over by the same Jews who ruled over them before. And the same goes for the land. It took a relatively strong hold of the new economy and turned it into an absolute hold over the economy. And making matters worse, they claim they did it in the name of the labor and peasants. István Diak writes the following. The great majority of the people's commissars, especially the communists, were not workers, but journalists, lawyers, teachers, bank clerks, and other intellectuals. Only a minority had any experience dealing with workers. Finally, the great majority of the people's commissars were Jews. Whether the proportion of Jews among the commissars was over 70%, as Eco claims, or 95%, as Oskar Jassy has argued, the fact remains that all truly important positions were occupied by people of Jewish background. Now, this is being written in mainstream journals. Academics will cover things up, but they have to admit that this is the case. Oskar Jassy, when he was immigrated to Vienna, after the failure of the revolution, he said that the Hungarian Soviet Republic was the first government in world history where Judaism had been brought to life without any limitation. The journal Zombat states, after 1919, the official policy of the party aimed to strengthen the proletarian dictatorship of the Jews with great fervor. Zombat, by the way, is a Jewish publication. So they're saying the following here, and this is quite open and quite mainstream. The revolution was Jewish. That Marxism was Jewish. that when they refer to the proletariat, they're referring to Jews. But we have the problem that, you know, they were members of the ruling class, a huge proportion of the ruling class prior to this. So they staged revolution against themselves. And the only answer could be is that they created, as I said, this, well, two things. They absolutized their control over the economy and destroyed the church. And the way they enforced this rule was through the London Boys. And they were irregular units. It's often the case in all communist countries had them. And they terrorized rural areas, which of course is a traditional domain of the Gentiles. They would deliberately provoke violence by they would turn a church into a club or a brothel, for example. And then they would be attacked by the peasants, obviously, and they'd kill the village in self-defense. Then they would rape women, treat them as sexual objects, and claim that they were collectivizing women and abolishing the family. It just brought even female sexuality under the control of the London Boys, and with all that implies. So they actually even would rape and give a fake theoretical reason why they would do so. On June 24th, 1919, the population had enough. The counter-revolutionary riot had broken out. So the London Boys wrote to Kuhn, and he said this: "The proletarian dictatorship is in danger. In Budapest, the counter-revolution is raging, but they haven't won yet. The last 3 days show that we can only quell the counter-revolution through blood." The Red State in Hungary was typical of Jewish Marxism. It just used the rhetoric of Marx to take power and really to destroy churches. They were given absolute control over the economy, media, and everything else, and used materialism of Marx to destroy churches. The Red Terror really didn't have much time to develop. This state didn't last very long. No one's entirely sure how many were killed. Mainstream say maybe 1,000 people. I'm sure it was much more than that. You didn't have strict record keeping in the countryside. But Bela Kun's career wasn't over. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Now, one of the many proofs that Bela Kun wasn't really a Marxist, and none of these people really were, they didn't care about equality or workers. Bela Kun is the first, and I've read everyone, you know, he's the first Marxist I've ever read. And these guys, it's almost a ritual. If you lead a communist country, you have to be a theoretician, which is often humorous. The odd thing about Kuhn's writings is that his primary opponent is the lower middle class. He says this over and over and over again. I have never come across a Marxist writer who says this. Listen to him. He says the following. And this is Kuhn himself writing. "Within the framework of capitalist society, the lower middle class is immortal. Not only do small traders and small producers, worshippers of the principle of private property and credit, inevitably ensure the existence of parasites in the social organism as being causes of the dissipation and waste of social labor, also from out of their midst appear bearers of a special philosophy directed for the purpose of restraining the proletarian revolution. And this is the very reason why the lower middle class masses are the most dangerous enemies of the dictatorship of the proletariat. They represent a very strong section of society. Their special interests are absolutely incompatible with the economic disturbances which are the inevitable accompaniment of transitional periods." Now, that's a lot of fluff there. But in traditional Marxism, the lower middle class are the proletariat. More proof that he's actually referring to an ethnic group rather than an economic class. At the very, very, very least, the lower middle class are the upper reaches of their proletariat. Never before has this class, which of course is comparatively poor and powerless, been the center of such contempt. You cannot find this in Marx, but you can find it in Jewish nationalism. The Gentile existentialist, Jean-Paul Sartre, who converted to Marxism near the end of his life, has a book on anti-Semitism. This is what he says. "Besides this, many anti-Semites, the majority perhaps belong to the lower middle class of the towns. They are functionaries, office workers, small businessmen who possess nothing. It is in opposing themselves to the Jew that they become conscious of being proprietors. In representing the Jew as a robber, they put themselves in the enviable position of people who could be robbed." Now, that mess of a statement proves what I've been saying all along. Those who took power under the name of Marxism in the 20th century, not only didn't care about labor or poor people, or those with very little, but hated them. These are, you know, people who possess nothing. Sartre says so. They're powerless. But they become members of the bourgeoisie in his mind because they oppose themselves to the Jew. So I've given you quite a bit of evidence that this is, you know, when they say proletariat, I think Trotsky was the same way. And yet in Marxism, the lower middle class are the proletariat. Capital despises the lower middle class and wants to destroy small business for the sake of expanding their market. The lower middle class includes only office workers and clerks and stuff like that, people with no power. In no way, according to Marx or Lenin or anyone else, are they oppressors. They are the oppressed. But it's no accident that that's exactly the class, speaking very generally, that served as a main force for National Socialism. The Soviet government lasted for 133 days total. They didn't have much time to kill anyone. It ended on the 1st of August, 1919. It's a very bizarre experiment because the Soviet state had been found on a nationalist basis. Once the Vicksnote was written and the borders were redrawn, the Hungarian Red Army was formed towards the end of eliminating that. That was a public agenda, anyway. The point being that this nationalist drive, the Magyar nationalist movement, which, by the way, I've always been, you know, suspicious of, in many ways. It was one of the harsher colonial systems around, as those in Transcarpathia will tell you. Nevertheless, it did have a claim after World War I, and yet this Jewish Kahal used it as a way to catapult themselves into power. And the strange thing, of course, is that they were able to point to the Soviet Union, which is just in the process of being created, that was promising Hungary assistance to restore their borders. So you even had some nationalists who didn't know what was going on quite yet look to the Soviet Union as a possible ally here. But it's not an exaggeration to call Kuhn's government a Jewish Kahal, and its sole purpose was to despoil Gentile property and destroy any vestige of Christianity left in the country. But because of that, it's fairly small numbers, it was very poorly led and poorly organized. They had no Gentile support. They weren't really able to raise an army when Romania invaded the country and overthrew him. He had members of the old Austro-Hungarian army that was in Hungary that served him only from a nationalist point of view. He promised to bring, you know, the Magyar state to its previous boundaries. He invaded Slovakia and then Transylvania. He succeeded in the former, failed in the latter. But they had no ability to really mobilize men. Not to mention, they had no real functional economy to fight a war of attrition anyway. So you have this bizarre situation of a Jewish Kahal taking power as a communist state on a nationalist basis and despising nationalism. The lack of popular support and the fact that the only army that they had was the old empire's army on Hungarian soil, most of whom were suspicious of Kuhn, was willing to fight for him only to the extent that they wanted to expand Magyar borders. They fell apart the minute Romania invaded the country. Kuhn had started that by invading Transylvania. Then Romania had invaded Hungarian territory, the disputed areas, to keep the post-treaty state the way it was. Lenin had promised Kuhn Soviet troops, the Red Army, to assist Kuhn in his war against Romania. Romania, of course, benefited from the Treaty of Trianon and liked the idea of a smaller Hungary. But partially because he didn't trust Kuhn, and partially because the Red Army had just suffered a substantial defeat in Ukraine, Lenin couldn't intervene. Kuhn functioned in the way he did because he just assumed that if he ever got into trouble, Lenin would help him out. And given those circumstances, it didn't happen. So on August 1st, the Romanians took Budapest. The man who took power afterwards was Admiral Nicholas Horthy, who I've written on in the past, a man who I admire. Unfortunately, Kuhn took the country's treasury with him to the Soviet Union. But the minute he fled, anti-Jewish riots broke out, which, as you can imagine, you know, it was unavoidable. Admiral Horthy was opposed to these things. But you can't restrain the anger of a population who'd been under Kuhn's arrogance for this period of time. There was no such thing as a white terror. That's propaganda. There was no such entity. First of all, to the extent that there was violence, it occurred from foreign troops who looted areas, especially Jewish areas. It was the local population who were outraged at the Lenin boys and their activities. And as well as the military officers who had enough of Kuhn's absurdities. So looting occurred for a few days prior to Horthy's ability to restore order. The white terror is just another myth, but to the extent that it existed at all, it was well earned. But this is how Admiral Horthy himself describes Kuhn's reign. The atrocities of the Bolshevists filled the land with terror. Their agitators penetrated even into our hitherto peaceful district. The peasants were terrorized by groups of men who went from village to village, held court-martial, and with sadistic pleasure, hanged all those who in the war had been awarded the gold medal for bravery. Terror is the principal weapon of our regime, boasted Tibor Samsi, the close collaborator of Kuhn, whose main function was that of an executioner. The Jews, who had long been settled among us, were the first to reprobate the crimes of their co-religionists, in whose hands the new regime almost exclusively rested. Now, Horthy was not anti-Jewish. What he wanted was, he was like he reminded me a bit of Denikin, head of the White Army in parts of Russia. He was a nationalist in a civic sense. He wanted a constituent assembly with all parties represented. But most of all, he wanted order. And now he says here that the Jews revolted against their, against Kuhn. And I want to say that he's very naive there. The Soviets and communists throughout the world were really outraged at Kuhn, not because he hurt anybody, but because he was so clumsy. He was just a nasty, a Jewish fanatic. And that he made it so blatant and didn't care who knew, really got other people angry, Lenin included. But once it was clear that Kuhn was finished, local Jews suddenly became anti-communists. They knew the game was up, and they turned around and said that they were always opposed to Kuhn, always opposed to him. I was there from the beginning, which I'm sure is a lie. I don't know in depth to what extent local Jews supported Kuhn. I can't imagine that they wouldn't. No doubt that there were some who did. There were plenty of Jews among the lower middle class. But given that this was a Jewish nationalist state, I highly doubt there was any real organized resistance. But as the Romanians took Budapest, and then Horthy, who became regent for the emperor and always had that title, as he took over, he was conciliatory. And I believe the Jews then covered for their crimes by saying that we were opposed to him all along. At the same time, though, Horthy is making reference to the fact that Jews had always done so well in Hungary, right up until that point, that being revolutionaries was, and I think for most people, that was just a bizarre thing, not realizing what it really was. They took Marxism at its word. I'm not talking about Karl Marx personally, I'm talking about his followers. But the other reason I think they said how they were opposed to Kuhn from the beginning was that it showed the world that Marxism was Jewish. And Jews were upset by this. I quoted the journal Equality, which was a Zionist journal, not an assimilationist journal. McCagg says that it had been taken over by Zionists, even though it had been assimilationist at one point. So you had both boots of the Jewish golem, both the assimilationists and the Zionists who wanted to leave the area as nationalists supporting Kuhn's system. But Balak Cohen wasn't finished. He embarrassed the communist cause throughout the world. He exposed how Judaic it all was. But probably because he had the entire treasury of the country in his hands, he fled to the USSR and met with Lenin. Lenin sent him to re-Bolshevize the Crimea. Lenin sent him to Baku to really be his eyes and ears over the Congress of Eastern Peoples. Then he was made a part of the military council of the Southern Front. And he was sort of like a political commissar under General Mikhail Frunze, who led the Red Army at the time. This is late 1919. The White Army was in a lot of trouble. They had recovered from their defeats from the Poles in Ukraine and then had regrouped with a lot of Western money and went back into the Crimea. Going back into the Crimea was where Lenin sent Cohen. I believe Lenin sent him because all Cohen cared about was this ultra-left Judaic ideology. Cohen could do things and commit atrocities that Lenin could then distance himself from. While the Red Terror in Hungary was only there for about 100 days or so, they only killed about 1,000 people, which, you know, it's a weekend for Marxism. In the Crimea, it was a very different story. Now, the story goes like this. After the Reds retook the Crimean Peninsula, Lenin officially offered amnesty to any of the white soldiers who remained, who hadn't fled yet, and there were some that were scattered and hiding in the mountains. I firmly believe that that was a lie, and that Kuhn was sent to subvert those orders. He proceeded to slaughter 60,000 Crimean and White Army prisoners of war. Unarmed, execution style, he killed them all. The upper reaches of this, 80,000, some people say, 60,000 is the norm. These were unarmed men. It was a process of ethnic cleansing, and it was understood such at the time. And commissars who were with him said he was so sadistic that the Red Army questioned his methods and said, you know, he's too much of a, he's too out of control. He's hurting our cause. Now, the reason I say that Lenin was aware of this and he sent Kuhn to do his dirty work was that he was never punished for it. In fact, he never even mentioned the events. He was sent to Germany. Now, so my theory is, and I'm almost certain it's true, is that Lenin wanted to slaughter these guys. Didn't want to do it himself. He's going to be the head of state soon. And so he sent this lunatic, this Jewish fanatic, to do his dirty work for him. I don't know what the new Soviet government was going to do with, you know, 80,000 white soldiers. So after his slaughter, and clearly the war was over in the Crimea, he went back to Lenin. Lenin said nothing. Remember, he completely disobeyed orders. The direct order was for amnesty. He disobeyed it, and Lenin didn't bother to notice. But that's why I'm certain that was the case. Anyway, he was sent to Germany, Saxony specifically, to start the revolution there. But, you know, there's more to the story than this. You know, after Kuhn had finished his slaughter, you know, pretty much the White Army in the area, that was POW, you know, within a month or so, Kuhn's forces had created a famine. It was an artificial famine created by the same requisitioning policies of the Lenin boys. So there's no doubt this was Kuhn's doing. In this case, he had more men and more support and soldiers who actually had combat experience. And so his men were able to go into the countryside again, the stronghold of Gentile, and simply take food. That's what requisitioning meant. And then once the administration was established, this is the end of 1921, the harvest was forced into export. And the Italian Red Cross, as always, screaming, like, can we support the Red Army in some way by alleviating this famine, offer their assistance, but politely they were declined. Meaning that they could have solved the famine here, and they refused. The famine was there for the Soviet creation, and Kuhn's creation, and Lenin's creation, indirectly. Lenin knew that Kuhn would do this and sent him there. It was his way of slaughtering many people without getting his own hands dirty. And it also shows how naive the Red Cross was, thinking that this famine was just, you know, because of a bad harvest rather than a political creation. He was rewarded for his actions by being sent to Germany to start the revolution there. In the spring of 1921, he showed up in Saxony. As many of you know, that there was a Soviet Republic in Bavaria, exclusively Jewish. But Saxony was considered, was an industrialized area, and it also had the Luna chemical works as well. It was very important to the German economy. And he was hated by everyone he came across. He was a fanatical Jewish, a secular Jewish nationalist. He was extremely arrogant. And even local Jews he ignored the views of local people. He went in thinking that he knew everything and ignored people on the ground there. He was impatient. He was impulsive. Was not exactly an intellectual, and this movement failed. Their support dwindled, so out of desperation, the party tried to provoke their supporters into violent action. Labor unions and everything else, they attempted to, there was a Jew by the name of Hugh Eberlein, one of the leaders of the German Communist Party, had a whole plan to create all these false flags. He wanted to fake kidnap party leaders and blame it on the police. He wanted to blow up the local munitions dump and blame it on, you know, he wanted to outrage people by creating fake crimes. Nothing came of it. This ultra-left Jewish faction was just seen as really just neurotic to the extreme. So, really, this was a desperate measure. A handful of communists occupied the Luna chemical works, and they called for mass action in support of strikes, and they were ignored. The party organized the violent action of dock workers in Hamburg. That also was ignored. Labor refused to support Kuhn. They refused to support this clearly Jewish movement. And ultimately, it was only a handful of Jewish leaders who acted, and acted very poorly, and they were crushed very quickly. Well, he went back to the Soviet Union and really was seen as a disaster. What do you do with the guy? He dabbled in publishing. And in general pomposity, he died. Well, his death is disputed. The official date is November 30th, 1939, in a prison camp. Later on, the Soviet government said in the destalinization campaign that he was killed in August of 1938. But then when the Soviet Union fell, and we actually had some useful records here, apparently he had been in prison briefly, was charged with leading a counter-revolutionary terrorist cult, and he was shot. And I believe the date is, I want to say August of 1938, but I'm not 100% positive on that. I don't think anyone is. And now, that is a story of Bela Kuhn. Now, for a long time, as many of you know, I've been preaching the same set of doctrines over and over again. I have a book coming out on the history of the Soviet Union. It's actually a set of essays. My donors get a copy of it, free. It's not quite finished, but it's a readable copy. It's a doc file. And it has a few theses that no one really is arguing. Number one, as I said before, Western powers and Western elites created the USSR. Number two, the Western governments didn't know what a Bolshevist was. They weren't theoreticians. No one could read Russian. So no one was entirely sure what these people were all about. They weren't anarchists, which was good. But they had no idea. They couldn't be opposed to something they didn't understand. Number three, they saw the Reds as a centralizing power, which was good because they wanted to industrialize the place. It was a huge untapped market, and they could therefore be a check on Germany and German eastern expansion, which is really the whole point of Russia in the Western mind. Number four, Marxism had nothing to do with labor. Throughout the history of communist governments throughout the world, they have done zero to improve the treatment or day-to-day life of workers. In the Soviet Union, they were mercilessly exploited, and that was the case everywhere. The closest anyone ever came was Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia, who had, if you want a humane socialist system, it was the one in Yugoslavia. He did attempt worker control over industry. He did attempt a means whereby workers could actually, you know, run the factory and have meetings before and after work, and understanding, you know, production targets and money and salaries and everything else. And the economy did relatively well in the 50s and 60s. The communist world came down on him like a ton of bricks. That's not what we're about. In Hungary, Kuhn had promised labor that they were going to be treated that way. And once he came to power, and the minute he did, he broke his promise. He simply nationalized industry. Nationalized meaning brought it under his own personal control. I personally have always been a firm supporter of worker control over industry. I despise capitalism, as many of you know. And these people couldn't function for 5 minutes without the struggles of labor, both physical and intellectual. The problem with worker control, as Tito found out, was that after an 8-hour shift, these guys don't want to sit around for another 4 hours talking about production targets. They want to get home. To own your own business, to run your own business is a not just a full-time job, it's a lifetime. You know, it's a 24-hour-a-day job. Running your own business is extremely difficult and extremely painful. The only time it gets good is if you can safely delegate, but that's often very rare for a small businessman. Tito's attempt to create worker councils succeeded, but the problem was it created a group of professional politicians who ran these councils. So Tito then demanded that there be a rotation. So now he's forcibly putting workers into these councils, whether they want to be there or not. And no matter what he did, it turned out to be an oligarchy no matter what. It turned out to be a group of people, workers on the council, I mean, a handful of them, who ran everything. So the 80-20 principle. No matter what he did, you can't help it. There's a small group that, no matter where they're from or what claim they have to control industry, they run the council. And most of these guys did everything in their power to skip the worker council meetings. But that was, he was an exception. He was a deviant in the Soviet system, in the communist system. But he came the closest to some version of worker control. And I believe that it's a laudable goal. And I think it can be done under certain circumstances, especially for huge industrial concerns. You also had to be career there. It couldn't just be, you know, having just some, you know, job for the sake of getting a job. It had to be your life to be there. And of course, the last point is that communism is largely Judaic. And of course, and I don't want to make a separate point that Stalin was not an anti-Semite. Stalin being an anti-Semite was a way that the left made it okay to hate the Soviet system. He was not. He was surrounded by Jews. Major positions around him were Jewish. He married two of them. His children married Jews. I mean, there's no question that he condemned anti-Semitism in his speeches and writings all the time. The problem was in purging the ultra-leftists and purging the old Bolsheviks meant by definition to purge the Jewish elite. So Jewish intellectuals in modern America have a choice. Either they could admit that the Soviet Union was founded by Jews, or call Stalin anti-Semite. They have to pick one of those two. So they had to pick the latter. What's happening now, as I think some of you see, that they're painting communism as a right-wing ideology, so long as it's Stalinist. They're doing it in North Korea, as well as in Stalin's Soviet Union. The alternative is to say that anyone who you purge from the old Lenin days is Jewish, and therefore the Soviet Union was Jewish. They can't say that. So they have to say that Stalin specifically targeted Jews. That's what that's all about. And those are the main points that I want to make. And that, of course, you know, holding them all together from an American point of view is that the U.S. was never anti-communist. The U.S. traded with the Soviet Union, invested in the Soviet Union. Marxist professors ran the universities. They were given huge grants by old money foundations. It wasn't ideology. Any empire that size is going to clash with the United States. There's no doubt about it. It's not ideology. It's nothing like that. It was merely because the Soviet Union was so damn big. Vietnam and Korean wars was the American way of saying no more expansion. I mean, my God, they gave half of Europe to Stalin under Roosevelt and Truman. That government could have been British liberal for all anyone cared, and still would have clashed with the U.S. It wasn't Marxism, it wasn't Bolshevism, and it certainly wasn't Judaism. The ultimate enemy, the only enemy, the sole exclusive enemy of internationalism, whether it be liberal or socialist, is nationalism. And that's what we do here. Thank God. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.